Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my guest co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined by commercial beekeeper Mr. Jim Doan to talk about his recent devastating losses, which has now ended his career as a third-generation beekeeper. So I would first like to welcome to the show my special guest co-host, Mr. Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June, and hello, Jim.
And our guest today, Mr. Jim Doan. Good afternoon, Jim, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, June. Thank you for having me. Good morning, Tom.
Jim, could you please tell the audience about yourself and how long you've been a beekeeper?
I have been a beekeeper for 45 years. My family, my grandfather, started the bee business, and I got my first hive when I was 5. Grew up in the bee industry. My parents were very active in the bee industry and packed honey, as well as ran about 1,500 hives of honeybees. When I was 5, I got my first hive of bees, grew my business, paid my way through college. My wife, when she married me, she knew nothing about the bee business, and we grew our business from 1,000 hives to up to 5,300 hives of bees that we were running in 2006 before we had our first encounter with the neonic.
And can you share with our audience exactly when you first began experiencing problems with your bees and you noticed that there was a pattern that was just a little more than the average loss that typically beekeepers experience?
In the fall of 2006, we noticed that our bees were struggling. We couldn't quite put a finger on it, but I had gotten a call from a relative of mine, David Hackenberg, and he had said that, you know, he was experiencing this big collapse, and he said to me, he says, "Are you seeing that?" And I was like, "Well, I really hadn't seen too much, but we knew something was not right with our bees." In the winter of 2006, we were getting ready to ship our bees to Florida. We were still here in New York in December. We went out to check our bees before we loaded them on the trucks, and we noticed that there were a lot of dead hives of bees that had looked like they starved to death but had honey. And we weren't having a real hard winter. It was fairly mild. By the time that 2006, beginning of 2007 had started, we had lost 90% of 5,300 hives of bees.
To nine beekeepers, Jim, a colony of bees is a little bit of an abstract concept. Can you give the listeners an idea of what that means financially to lose several thousand colonies of bees?
When we lost that amount of bees, it was very devastating because, first off, you don't know why you lost them. So what we ended up, we went out and we spent about $90,000 and went out and bought a little over 1,000 hives of bees and took and divided those out, and we were able to get ourselves back to about 3,300 hives of bees. But it probably cost us $120,000, $130,000 to get back to 3,300 with what we had and what we went out and bought. At that point, we were in over our head as far financially, because you just can't make that kind of money back profit-wise in this business. Anywhere it is, and the price of honey wasn't that high at that point. We were probably looking at honey that was $1, $1.10 to $1, somewhere in that range at that point. So your return just wasn't good enough to pay for that. But we figured, well, you know, it was a one-time loss. We could sustain it and move on, because in the past, we've always been able to take our bees, divide them, winter them, and come out of the next spring with more bees than we started with. You know, our normal winter loss was 10% at the most. You know, we could make up bees. In fact, it used to be a joke with my father that he'd be like, no, stop making up bees. We just don't need any more. Today, we're constantly making up bees. All the time is really what we were doing, you know, bees throughout the summer, throughout the winter, to try to stay with enough bees that we could even stay in business.
Yes, I've seen a complete reversal in my time as a beekeeper. In the early days, I know any number of commercial beekeepers who started with one or two colonies, and those get split. They pick up swarms, and before they knew it, they had several hundred and then several thousand, and it's a complete reversal today of what we experienced just 10 or 15 years ago.
10 years ago, Tom, we could take our bees, and a lot of times when we came out of apples, we would divide them in two because we would have queen cells in them. I think in 2007, we got a real lesson about what something does to our bees, whether it's neonic or whatever. We were not sure at that point back in 2007, but we divided our bees. We let them raise queen cells, and every hive that we divided like that died. And so that was the first time we'd ever experienced that, where our bees would just collapse after we divided them. We had then to go to mated queens, which was not something we were not at that point spending a lot of money on mated queens. We had been using an awful lot of our own stock to divide our bees up with. So that was a big shock to our business, was having to go out and buy queens, which a queen today costs $20. To buy, probably then we were paying 8 to 10. That's more money that we were spending that we didn't know where we were going to get it from at that point.
Early on, we weren't sure just what was causing these unexpected losses, but as time has gone on, we've zeroed in closer and closer to what we believe to be the problem, and it appears that the systemic pesticides, the neonicotinoids, are playing a major role here. Can you just describe what the effect has been on your operation from those pesticides and what the nature of the losses has been, what the source has been?
Sure. We back in 2007, when we started trying to figure out exactly what was going on, I had heard a little bit about imidacloprid. Really didn't know anything about them. Apparently, they had been on the market for a little over a year or two in this area. And what we saw was our apple farmers were using them. Our first experience was, again, this coming out of pollination, and suddenly we couldn't raise queens. We couldn't get our hives to divide normally. The queen cells that they were raising were no good. Then we'd heard that they were starting to using it on corn and soybeans. Well, apparently they'd been using it on corn and soybeans. It was the first that we had learned about it. And what we've seen since then, as we're pulling samples, we've had Dr. Jeff Pettis in our bees from the USDA. We've had Marion Fraser from Penn State in our bees pulling samples of wax and pollen and bees. And quickly, we were showing up with all these neonics in our beehives, in our pollen and our wax. We were just experiencing these huge losses winter after winter, and even in the summertime. As I go through my bees, you could just see a general change in them the minute that the chemicals started to be used. You know, you could go through March and the bees would look real good, and as soon as April came, the bees would start to go down, and you could just see a general change. In fact, it was so frustrating because the bees absolutely would not do what they should have been doing. You know, in all my years of beekeeping, I've never had bees not do what they're naturally born to do. And it becomes an issue of, well, what am I doing wrong? And for quite a while, we went through and we were trying to figure out, well, what were we doing wrong? We had no idea that these neonics were out there in the volume they were, or causing the problems that they were causing. And not everyone experienced it at the same time. It seemed like my cousin Hackenberg and myself seemed to be having a lot more issues than a lot of people. And people would come up to us and go, well, we hear you're having these problems. We think maybe, well, it could be mites. You know, maybe you're having a mite issue. And it's like, well, we're not having a mite issue because we've got our mites under control. And, you know, they'd be like, well, what's your mite counts? And I'd be like, well, we're running the zeros to the threes. And they go, well, we're running more mites than that in our bees. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And people would ask a lot of questions. And, you know, it would be frustrating to me because they couldn't understand what we were experiencing. Finally, when people started experiencing, they're like, well, you've been telling us about this, but we've never seen it before. And they just couldn't understand, you know, what was going on with their bees. And quite honestly, I had people that, you know, I could hear them behind my back, oh, he's just a piss poor beekeeper. You know, that's what this is all. He's just not taking care of his bees.
Yes.
And it was never the case that we were dumping huge amounts of money into them, both with feed, because we went to the pollen substitute, we went to syrup, feeding only sucrose, feeding only sugar. We went to the organic compounds for mites, figuring, well, maybe something. We gave up treating for foul bird because, well, we thought, well, maybe something in the foul bird medicine is causing us a problem. I mean, we went through a lot of different things, Tom, trying to figure out what we had done wrong, never realizing that it was not us at all that had done anything wrong, that it was the environment that we were putting our bees into, which was wrong.
I'd like to talk just for a minute about the neonicotinoids. The first neonicotinoid was imidacloprid, and that came out in, I think, 1994, and you mentioned that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In 2003, a second neonicotinoid came out, clothianidin, which has been the most widely used agriculturally. Imidacloprid is more focused on urban and suburban environments. And it's always been my understanding that in those early years, the state of New York found that imidacloprid was migrating off-site. They were finding it in deep wells. And as a consequence, they decided to register imidacloprid as a controlled use substance. In other words, not everybody could go in and buy it. You had to have an applicator's license and you had to meet certain qualifications. And it was also my understanding that the state of New York refused to register clothianidin because of their concerns. But I've learned just recently from you that clothianidin is used extensively in the state of New York, even though the state has refused to register it. Could you describe just what's going on? Because it's a puzzle to those of us who are looking at what's taking place. Where are states' rights here?
Well, it's an interesting thing, Tom. When I first learned about clothianidin, and, well, when we had our first major bee kill as far as actually finding dead bees out front of our hives, and we hadn't had one in 25 years of me keeping bees where we could actually find a lot of dead bees laying in front of a hive of bees. We went and called the Department of Environmental Conservation, which in New York State is responsible for pulling samples. And I said to them that we had had a bee kill. We thought it was related to corn dust. And in particular, we thought it was probably clothianidin. Well, the first thing they said to me, well, that's not a registered product in New York State. We can't come out and pull a sample. And I'm like, I don't understand. If it's not registered, how can it be being used? And they were like, well, we're not exactly sure, but it has something to do with seed. And so I called the New York State Department of Seed because they actually have a department in the ag and markets where they control seed movement in the state. And what I found out was that treated seed with clothianidin is allowed in New York State. It can't be treated in New York State, but if it's treated in another state, then it can be brought into New York and used through interstate seed transportation. I was dumbfounded because how can a chemical be banned and yet it's still allowed to be used on seed? And it's all the corn seed, all the soybean seed, all the green bean seed, all the pea seed is treated with clothianidin. Most of the corn sold in New York State is treated with clothianidin. Now, there is some that's treated with thymotoxin, but thymotoxin, when it breaks down, is clothianidin. So we found right away that our levels of clothianidin were very high. It hadn't been something that we really were looking for because it wasn't a registered product in New York State. The explanation they gave me was because it's strictly through seed movement that they cannot control the usage of it in New York State. It is a very frustrating thing to me to understand how a chemical is allowed to be used even though it's not registered for use in New York.
Yeah, these are some very toxic chemicals and very small amounts can have very significant effects. You mentioned the fact that thiamethoxam breaks down into clothianidin. Imidacloprid is an interesting story, too, because some of the breakdown products of imidacloprid are even more toxic than the parent compound.
Yes.
Jim, can you talk about what the response was from the EPA as well as industry?
Sure. What we ran into when we first went to EPA a year ago, because that was when we had our first really big bee kill, EPA was like, well, you got to get, you know, someone's got to get out there to pull a sample. And they go, well, your Department of Environmental Conservation. And I told them, well, they're not going to do it. They said they're not coming out. And they were dumbfounded because New York State, I mean, registers chemicals. And DEC is responsible for this. So I called our Department of Ag and Markets bee inspection, and they said, well, we'll come out and pull a sample, because I wanted to make sure that I had a legal sample in case we were going to have some type of legal action against whoever had killed our bees. Because at that point, we knew it was corn, or we were pretty sure it was corn, but we weren't positive, obviously. So they sent out an inspector, and, of course, he checked for mites to make sure that we did not have any mite issue, which we didn't. And he checked for other diseases to make sure that we didn't have Nosema or American foulbrood, that our bees were healthy before they'd been hit. And that wasn't very hard to show, because the hives that were hit were three-story colonies of bees that had basically two boxes of brood and a box of honey on them at that point. When he got a look at them, there was about 3 to 4 frames of bees left, and there was enough brood for 9 to 10 frames. And you could see the brood had died, or had died very recently. So the Department of Ag and Markets came out, they pulled samples, and then they were like, well, we can't release these samples to have them run by Gastonia, because I want them to go to the USDA bee lab through Penn State, because they have a program to help beekeepers to run have samples run, and they cost share with you. They pick up 50% of the cost through Mary Ann Frazier's Cooperative Extension Program down there at Penn State. And New York said, well, we're not going to release them. We've got your samples. We're not going to release them. And I went ballistic and called EPA and said, these samples are being held now by New York State, they won't release them. Well, EPA apparently made some phone calls, and they got the samples finally released to go to Penn State so that we could get them run. But they have not, as far as EPA, I mean, they have not done anything as far as an investigation to determine, you know, why, how this corn dust got into these bees, or why these bees should have died of corn dust. But we now know that for sure the bees had gotten chlorothianidin from the corn that was planted around those orchards, and apparently had drifted into the orchard where the bees picked it up. You know, the EPA never did anything in regards to following up with that. Tom knows that last year EPA only reported, I believe, 24 bee incidents, and yet I know of multiple people that had incidents that occurred where the bees were killed or severely knocked back by some type of corn planting. But for some reason, whatever reason there is that EPA has excuses for, these were never reported. We know for a fact that sometimes there's information that's taken by EPA that doesn't seem to show up on their database. And that seems to be a pretty common occurrence. And, you know, when you talk to them down there at EPA, they'll say, well, we don't have enough reports to do something in regards to chlorothianidin or thymotoxin. Well, if the reports come up missing, then it's pretty hard to have enough reports. And it's a very frustrating thing. The EPA, they say they're working on new guidance to get their inspectors to go out in the field, but their inspectors are, you know, each state. Each state is responsible for pulling samples. We've had a lot of cases across the country where the state simply refused to go out and pull samples.
Well, this has been an issue for many years, and
yes,
experienced beekeepers simply do not make reports, because what they've found is that when they do, what the EPA is most likely to do is to go over their operations with a fine-tooth comb and find
right.
some irregularity and persecute the beekeepers. Just recently, just within the last week or two, the EPA has issued new guidelines for their investigators. They're the most confusing, draconian, convoluted regulations I have ever seen. And I was talking with another commercial beekeeper, and I said, this is like being sideswiped on the interstate by an illegal semi, exceeding the speed limit, driven by an unlicensed driver, and before any investigation of the accident proceeds, you're required to provide the complete maintenance history on your vehicle, your driving record, and everything else. It's not protection, it's persecution. This is craziness.
That's right. That's exactly right. The onus falls on us that we didn't do anything wrong, rather than on surrounding farms that they didn't do something that they weren't supposed to be doing. And that's crazy, when I'm expected to meet a higher standard than the people surrounding me. How is it that it's not illegal to be planting corn or soybeans or any other product with insecticide on it, and you don't need a license to do it? Yet, if you go into an apple orchard, the apple farmers are required to have spray licenses in order to apply any of the chemicals that they're applying. This is just dumbfounding to me. And I don't understand this, that they are allowed to apply chemicals to a field because they're on the seed treatment. They don't need a license. Because an apple farmer or anyone else that's spraying an insecticide or a fungicide onto a field has to have a license. And yet farmers who plant corn and soybeans and green beans and peas, how they're planting it, they can put on a higher concentration than what is recommended. And what we're finding is with corn, they've gone from 25,000 seeds to the acre to pushing 40,000 or more seeds to the acre of corn. Well, it increases the concentration of a chemical on that field. And there's still the same amount of 1 acre, but there's a lot more chemical on that 1 acre. What we're seeing and what we're hearing is that this stuff is building up in the soil. We saw this spring in several of our apple groves that the bees simply would not work in the growth. And the feeling is that my discussions with some of the researchers is that we've got enough of these neonics now in these apple orchards that actually the bees can smell it, and they will simply not work in those orchards anymore. That they realize that it's poison that they would be collecting. I had at least 5 growers tell me they saw no honeybees, no bumblebees, no solitary bees. We spent some time walking around in orchards, saw the same thing. There was just no bees. There were bees flying in and out of the hives, but they were not working in the orchards. And I'm hearing this from across the country, that similar incidences occurred where apple growers complained to the beekeepers. The beekeepers went out and in some cases changed the bees, even brought in different hives, and still had the same results, that the bees would not work in those orchards.
And these products are not just being used on corn and on orchards. They're being used on millions and millions of acres of agricultural land all across the country.
Correct. We're seeing it as I talk to my farming friends. Imidacloprids, any of the neonics, are being used on all segments of agriculture, from cabbage grown in this area, green beans, to peas, to apples, any of your stone fruits like peaches and pears. They're even using it on strawberries and crops like that. It's being used in lawn care. It's across the board. This group of chemicals is being used, and yet nobody's keeping track of it. If you're allowing interstate movement of seed without keeping track of the chemical, well, how do you know how much is really being used out there? And if it is gathering in the soil, like we're hearing about from research, that there's a lot of this product being left over, I believe in the Italian study, they showed that only 4% of the active ingredient is actually used by the plant. The other 96% is left in the soil to collect in groundwater or just to be in the soil itself. You start accumulating this stuff, and so maybe you grow corn for 9 years and then you decide to rotate in alfalfa. That alfalfa has just as much chlorothianidin in it or thymotoxin as did the corn that they grew before that. And so it's toxic to the bees. The beekeeper brings in bees, and hopefully the bees won't work the stuff. But if they do, if they get hungry enough, you know, anybody will eat anything if they get hungry enough. And a bee is no different. They'll go out and collect this, and it will kill them. In our hives, we have hundreds of frames that are literally full of pollen that the bees have sealed over because it's encapsulated. It's full of poison, and we know it's full of poison. It's been tested by Penn State, and yet the bees collect it. They have to. And they will eat it if they get into starvation mode.
As the evidence has grown of contamination, you would think that we would be taking a closer and closer look at what that contamination represents. But the fact is, there is a movement afoot to turn these systemic pesticides into stealth chemicals, and here's how it works. They want to remove the seed treatment, which is one of the widest uses in history. They want to remove seed treatment from the category of a pesticide usage. In other words, there would be no record kept of how much seed is treated and where it goes and what the effect is. And it's just astounding.
Well, I think also what's astounding is the fact that there have been no human health studies. The bottom line is, especially since bees are an indicator species, we have no idea what the health impact is going to be, especially from all the people that are consuming the produce produced by these farms, as well as the exposure to plants, trees, and shrubs that homeowners are using, as well as any product used on their lawn. And if you think about it, how many people walk barefoot on their lawn, allow their children to, their pets? It's absorbed into the system, and no studies have been done. And I think the fact that this has taken place, and especially the devastating losses that you've experienced, Jim, really are a clear picture of what other commercial beekeepers in America, unfortunately, are going to experience as well.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Jim. I think a lot of beekeepers are. There are still beekeepers out there, much like myself when we first had it happen, that just are in disbelief. They're in denial that, you know, it's actually neonics that are killing their hives. I've talked to a lot of beekeepers across the country, and beekeepers will say to me, well, it was a drought last summer. It was, you know, well, my mite counts were a little bit higher than maybe they should have been. It was, well, we didn't get the feed into them that we should have. And what I'll say to them is, well, now think back. Haven't you had dry years where you made a lot of honey? And they'll be like, well, yeah. And did your bees winter okay? Well, yeah. And I said, well, what's different? And they'll be like, well, there is a lot more corn grown here. And I'm like, and that isn't a problem? Oh, no, bees don't work corn. Well, they don't think about dust coming off a corn seed or soybean seed as a problem, because it's not something we really see too much of.
That's one of the problems, though.
Right.
That it's not something that's visible, because the seeds are treated before they're planted.
Right. That's right. Beekeepers just don't recognize it. It took us a couple of years to really recognize that this is where we were having the problem. You can really see it when you start looking and going, okay, my bees look good. They start planting corn, all of a sudden my bees go downhill. There's a direct correlation between the two things. And yet other beekeepers go, well, the weather changed or this happened. Beekeepers are great at making up their own excuses why they did something wrong.
They're now hearing it all over the news.
Oh, yeah.
That it's the beekeeper's fault.
That's right.
Not the fact that neonicotinoids by design were created to kill insects.
That's right.
It's just that the scientists that created these chemicals didn't account for the fact that the honeybee is not an insect that will eat the plant.
Right.
It simply collects the pollen, so on and so forth, and it was one of those factors that they neglected to consider until after they started having issues. And at this particular point, when you're dealing with a multi-billion dollar industry, what do you do?
Right.
So it'll be interesting, but just the shift in the tide where now it's all the beekeepers.
Right.
The beekeepers are not feeding them enough, or it's something with the sugar water, or possibly they're feeding the bees high fructose corn syrup. It's ridiculous.
Right.
And the bottom line is a pesticide is created to kill an insect.
Right. So this winter, I think a lot of people got a bad taste in their mouth because what they found was that they had fed their bees, suddenly their bees die, and they're just like, well, what happened? And Brett Adie, who's someone that, well, he runs the most bees in this country, started out the winter with 90,000 hives, and Brett was telling me that back in October he had gone through some bees, and they were excellent bees. They were heavy. They looked beautiful. And he came back 10 days later to put pollen patties on them, and a third of the hives were dead, just completely missing the bees. And Brett was like, what the devil is going on? Brett had never seen it up close. You know, he had heard about this from other people, but never seen it. And I think after Brett saw it, Brett was like, I've never seen it. I've never experienced anything like this. I've never seen where the bees just disappear. And when you run 90,000 hives of bees, you're considered a pretty good beekeeper. Their family's been in beekeeping a long time. And when Brett says, I just did not understand it, other than I knew there was corn planted around, and now he's gotten a case of religion about this. And a lot of other people have, too, that there is something they couldn't put their finger on before that suddenly they're like, well, wait a minute, this is what people are talking about. Now I see it with my own eyes, just how this happened. Brett, of course, has not been able to make back his bees, and nobody else has either. Nobody else is out there going, well, gee, I've got more bees than I had last year. If there is, they're a very unique case because most people have not been able to make back their bees. What happened to us was this past spring, we were in Florida. Our bees were setting in oranges, and a farmer decided to spray in the middle of orange bloom.
So those were your bees that happened to? I'd heard about
that. Yeah, there were 15,000 hives of bees killed roughly in this area of Florida, and we lost about 300 and some out of 400 in this one grouping. It was a very, very sad moment for us because we thought we had some pretty good plans. I mean, we basically, not only did we lose the 300 some hives, but we lost all our increases that we could have made off of them. It sent us way back, and then we got up here to New York. We started putting bees out in the orchard, and things didn't go too bad, and we started moving our bees back out of orchard, and then suddenly we got hit with corn planting all around us, and right here in my own backyard, we had about 400 hives, and they planted corn, and 12 hours later, you could go out and see the dead bees crawling away from the hives and piling up around the hives. But within 24 hours, the queens were laying out front. You could actually see the queen laying there at the entrance, dead.
It's important for beekeepers and non-beekeepers alike, though, to understand that we focused on corn dust. But even if you escape the corn dust, the environment has been pervasively poisoned, and you can have both acute, dramatic effects, but you can also have long-term sublethal effects.
Exactly.
The non-target plants will draw up these products and become poisonous themselves. And while you mentioned earlier that bees don't work corn, they certainly don't work corn at the time that it's being planted. But later in the summer, bees will work corn heavily for pollen. It's a rich pollen source because it's wind-pollinated and has to produce a lot of pollen. And that pollen appears to be poisonous as well, along
Correct.
With many other flowering plants. The environment has been totally poisoned with these chemicals, it appears.
Right. Bees in our area work soybeans. If it's hot and dry, they'll work the devil out of soybeans because there's a lot of nectar there. And it's been reported more than once that people have made quite a surplus of honey off of soybeans. And soybeans are treated with chlorothianidin. And green beans and peas are both big nectar-producing crops here in the Northeast. And again, they're treated with chlorothianidin. So our exposure rate over a long period of time is tremendous. It used to be we considered we only got hit coming out of apples. If we could stay away from fruit, that we could get our bees healthy again. But unfortunately now, what we're finding is we're getting long-term exposure over 3, 4, 5 months. And then the bees have it stored in the hives. And, you know, people talk about the winter loss. Well, we're experiencing basically a year-round loss. It's just in the winter time, once our bees go into not gathering food, then they start consuming those supplies of pollen and honey that they've stored. And that's just totally loaded with these chemicals. That's why we see the big losses in October, November, December, and January, is because that's all they have to eat. Even if we're feeding them supplement, a bee is going to still eat that contaminated pollen, that contaminated honey that they have in there. I mean, it's a natural thing for them to do, is to eat that stuff. It maybe isn't what we want them to do, and some guys have tried pulling actually the frames out of their hives with honey. We went to trying to take our hives and strip them down to a single box to try to take away as much of the food as we could. But even that has not been totally successful in keeping our bees from dying.
Jim, you've had to make a very difficult decision with respect to your own beekeeping operation. What do you foresee as the future for American beekeeping?
I see nothing good. I mean, our decision to get out of bees this year was based on multiple factors. I mean, our obviously devastating loss in Florida, getting hit again back here in New York. We came up to New York with 1,100 hives of bees. Basically, what I see right now is we have about 300 hives left. You know, when I look around, at one time this was considered one of the prime areas to produce honey in New York State, and today it's cleared off ground. There's no available space for bees to produce honey. There's a few wooded lots left, but as far as open fields, meadows, there's no hay grown up here anymore. All the ground is being tilled. They're taking golf courses in this area and converting them into cornfields. They're taking woodlots that have been woodlots for 75 years and converting them. I'm hearing the same thing out of the Midwest from beekeepers all over the country, that there's just huge amounts of acreages of land that's being turned into production agriculture, in particular for corn. I see no future for beekeeping here in the United States. Even though the almond growers and the apple farmers, anybody that's in fruit needs bees, the vegetable growers, there's simply not going to be bees available. People can't produce bees just for doing pollination.
And if we wind up doing what they have to do with Madagascar vanilla, in which they hand pollinate in order to produce vanilla, it'll be interesting to see just how many people it's going to take to pollinate one almond grove.
Right.
If that's what they think that they're going to be doing, because I don't know where they're going to be getting the amount of bees that are required to pollinate some of these key crops.
That's correct. You know, when we sat down and I finally said, this is enough, I cannot continue to keep bees like this, I'm looking at what the future of beekeeping is in the United States, and I see no future in not commercial beekeeping. There'll be people that'll be able to have 5 or 10 hives here and there, you know, in very select locations. But as far as commercially being able to keep a viable bee industry, I just don't see that happening. They didn't have enough bees for almonds this year. They didn't have enough bees for blueberries this year. We barely had enough bees in New York State for covering the fruit crop. It takes about 15,000 hives of bees to cover apples just in New York. I represent 10% of that pollination. I will not be 10% of it next year. I doubt I will have a hive of bees left, or I'll just have a hive or two. But my wife and I have decided we're going to go find something else to do, something where we can actually not have to worry about where we're going to get bees from or be able to make up bees. It's just too frustrating.
Well, it's kind of hard when the cards are stacked against you. It's kind of hard to keep trying when there's just no point.
Right.
And I think that's where you're at right now. There just is no point because you're not getting any relief anywhere. And the more that you try to replenish your stock, it just gets killed. And
right.
That, from a personal perspective, it's really hard to watch a part of your life. Bees aren't just something that you do. It is your life.
Right.
And every time that you're exposed to these chemicals, you know that you're not going to have bees.
I think it's important for the hobbyist to understand here that they don't exist in a vacuum. The bee industry is supported largely by the demand of the commercial beekeepers. They're the ones who keep the package producers and queen breeders alive, the equipment manufacturers. And if we cut out the heart of the business, the hobbyist beekeepers, as important and motivated as they may be, are going to find it not only very difficult to keep their bees alive, but to find bees at all. We're looking at an enormous ecological collapse here.
Right. No, you're exactly right, Tom. I mean, hobbyists depend on commercial people to produce nukes for them, and if the commercial people aren't there, then there's no nukes. I've had several hobbyists go, well, we're doing a little bit of pollination. You know, you must be upset with us. I'm not upset with you. I can't possibly do all the pollination that's necessary to be done out there. They have a niche to fill, but they're not going to fill the niche of, I have pollination accounts that require 300 hives of bees. Well, that doesn't mean 300 hobbyists are going to show up each with a hive of bees. That's not going to happen. Or not.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
No.
Yeah.
No, most hobbyists are not set up to haul bees. Most hobbyists have no knowledge of how to haul a hive of bees around. I've seen people load hives of bees in the back seat of the car. God bless them that they can do that, but they're not going to do that regularly. That's not going to work commercially. And I believe this country is going to face a major crisis next year of lack of bees to do the pollination. And that will be the beginning of the end of commercial fruit growing and possibly commercial vegetable growing in this country, because
it's a domino effect.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And even within our industry, queen breeders will tell you there's not enough queen breeders right now to handle all the demand for queens. Some of my queen breeders told me they're only doing commercial people. They're not doing hobbyists because they don't have time, and they're all overwhelmed. They're just simply overwhelmed with the amount of orders that they're getting, and yet there's nobody new coming into the queen breeding business. It's not like there's a huge demand.
There isn't really an opportunity.
Right. But where would you
can't, especially when you...
Where would you set up a queen operation today that you wouldn't be exposed to all these problems? Success rate on raising queens, you've got to be able to get 70, 80, 90% of your queens to take. If not, then you're spinning your wheels.
We went out to California to pick up a load of packages this spring, and I was struck by the amount of acreage that is being flooded for rice production. And the EPA last year approved the use of these systemic pesticides as a seed treatment and foliar application on rice. These are water-soluble products that migrate with the groundwater. California found in 89% of the samples of surface water that they had taken, 89% of the samples showed imidacloprid. These results are occurring in the area where the queen breeders are, and it's become such a hostile environment that it's going to be very challenging for them to continue.
Well, gentlemen, we are out of time. Jim, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with our audience. I wish you all the best, and I'm very sorry for your losses.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. This is a heartbreaking story for all of us, whether we're beekeepers or not.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.